Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that this month marks 5 years since Premier Insight was launched, bringing you this and many other podcasts designed to deepen your faith. Since 2020, God has used this ministry to reach millions with over 20 million downloads of Premier Insight content, including one longtime atheist who shared, "I find this show and its guests deeply engaging as I continue on my personal faith journey." This ministry is completely reliant on the support of friends like you. That's why on this anniversary month, we're asking you to take just a moment and provide whatever gift is possible to keep this ministry going strong. If you believe this kind of ministry is needed and that more people need to be reached with this content, then I'm asking you to respond with a gift today. Just go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death today. Thank you for your generosity. Now, let's get into today's episode.
Hi, I'm Michael Bird, co-host of the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, and I want to ask you, what exactly is the gospel? You'd think Christians would generally agree on this, but actually, there are some rich and important differences in how the gospel can be understood. That's why I edited with Jason Mastin a new book called 5 Views on the Gospel, part of the Counterpoint series from Zondervan Academic. We've gathered together 5 absolutely brilliant scholars: Michael Horton, Scott McKnight, David DeSilva, Julie Marr, and Shively Smith, each offering a different take on what the gospel really is. Justification by faith, declaring Jesus is King, spiritual transformation, liberation from oppression. I mean, each view is, in a sense, rooted in scripture and history and contemporary mission, but they don't always agree. This book explores, what are we saved from? What are we saved for? And what does it mean to live a life worthy of the gospel? Whether you're a preacher, a student, or just curious, 5 Views on the Gospel will challenge and deepen your understanding of the good news of Jesus Christ. Available now wherever good theology books are sold.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're going to pick up on a new story that I think you spotted over the last few days coming out of Canada, which is the news that the Quebec College of Physicians, so these are the doctors, kind of representative official doctors body in the province of Quebec in Canada, has recommended that Canada's euthanasia program should be extended to newborn babies who are born with disabilities.
Yeah, this is, of course, an ongoing debate, which I've been involved with going back sort of 20, 30 years as in my work as a neonatologist. But it's just interesting to see the steady progression of attitudes towards euthanasia, or as it's described in Canada, medical assistance in dying, or MAID. And one of the interesting things, which I don't really understand why, is that the province of Quebec has always been the most liberal and most actively proposing MAID. I think that's true. Doesn't it go, Tim, into the introduction of MAID into Canada?
Yes. So we've discussed this in a few different previous episodes, which we'll link in the notes to this episode. But as a very quick, brief recap, euthanasia kind of arrived in Canada as a result of a Supreme Court decision about 10 years ago, which ruled that it was incompatible with Canada's kind of constitutional position to not offer a form of assisted suicide. It was a case brought by some Canadians or the relatives of Canadians who had ended up traveling overseas to end their lives. And as often is the case, the law that was originally passed back in, this is kind of 2016, 17-ish, was quite tightly drawn. So you had to be suffering from a terminal illness. Your death was supposed to be reasonably foreseeable, which is initially interpreted to be about 6 months or so. And you had to be over 18 in sound mind, able to give informed consent on the day of your death. And it was originally the option of being an assisted suicide, or if you didn't want to kind of take the lethal drugs yourself, a doctor could do it for you. And what had happened very quickly is Canada has become a very classic, almost extreme example of the slippery slope, and how within a few years of that law coming into force, not only was it being taken up in numbers much greater than anyone anticipated, but that very quickly, some pro-euthanasia doctors, some patient groups, some kind of political activists were demanding that it be expanded. So first, they chiseled away at the point from 6 months to 2 years to 10 years to, you don't actually have to be terminally ill at all. You just have to be ill in some description. Then they wanted to expand it to include mental health conditions. Then they wanted to expand it to say, you should be able to do what's known as advanced decisions. So you could make a legally binding request for euthanasia that kicks in down the line when you might no longer be kind of mentally competent because of your dementia or some other condition. And then they wanted to push it beyond into children as well. And so first it was so-called kind of mature minors. So these are kind of 15, 16, 17-year-olds on the cusp of adulthood who are deemed to be kind of have the maturity to request euthanasia. But this is obviously another pushing forward of the envelope. Now, the doctors committee in Quebec are saying, we would like to have the law to be able to let us euthanize newborn children who have severe disabilities or abnormalities.
So it's interesting that the Quebec College of Physicians, even before the law, the Supreme Court's judgment, was pushing for this back in 2014, said it was prepared to cross the line on the debate over euthanasia and proposed that it be included as part of the appropriate care. So clearly there are a body of doctors in Quebec who have been sort of pushing forward on this. And there are undoubtedly doctors who feel that this is their medical calling. Yeah. You know, that if you frame, why am I here? I'm here to minimize suffering. I'm here to prevent people suffering. If that is your primary frame, then you can see why, you know, ending suffering by effectively mercy killing people who seem to be suffering is a wonderful fulfillment of your medical calling. And recently, and again, perhaps we'll link in the show notes, there's appeared journal articles by euthanasia doctors in Canada describing their activities as an enormously fulfilling role. You know, that one doctor said they used to be there at the time of birth, they were an obstetric doctor, now they're at the end of life, easing life towards its end. And and of course, looking in from the outside, that's a cause of real concern. Doctors are potentially very dangerous people.
Yes, and I think it's interesting, isn't it, to reflect that in times gone by, there was a kind of folkloric kind of fear of the doctor, you know, going back even to the kind of pre-modern medical era, because they had this kind of knowledge of potions and poisons and what things in the natural world caused you harm. And they were sometimes kind of reviled figures, because they didn't really know what they were doing and didn't know how to cure people, but also because people were aware that actually they give you this thing to drink and you're just supposed to trust them, but actually maybe it will kill you. And they have this kind of almost mystical power at the death. And so that's why I think a lot of modern medicine has developed kind of built-in safeguards and guardrails and ethical standards to try and say, you know, to kind of denude the power of the doctor as this kind of mystical bringer of life or death, to say, no, doctors are here just to heal, not to harm.
Yes, absolutely. So in the history of medicine, it all goes back to this you know, potent figure of the healer, magician, and bringer of death. You know, the mystical figures. It's where it goes way back. And it is interesting that even today it is said that in many sub-Saharan African villages, you can find the figure of the medicine man.
Yeah.
And the medicine man is not a cuddly, you know, kind of
safe
GP
person.
Figure that you go to see when you've got a medical problem. The medicine man is always treated with caution and respect and fear, because yes. The same person who has the power to heal has the power to kill. And in fact, historically, the evidence suggests that the first group that ever made the differentiation between healing and killing were the group of Hippocratic physicians in sort of 300 to 400 years before Christ. And it was probably their Pythagorean commitments to this. The Pythagorean cult had a kind of belief in the mystical spirit within human beings. And that's why the Hippocratic physicians took a solemn oath that they would use their skill only to heal and never to harm. Mm. And interestingly, you know, the modern medical profession can be traced all the way back to that Hippocratic commitment.
Mm. And doctors, even to this day, I believe, still have to take the Hippocratic oath.
Well, in fact, the majority don't. There are, and those that do it in a very sanitized form. But it's nonetheless that one of the Hippocratic tags which has been passed on was primum non nocere, which basically means first do no harm. And that is still a absolute guiding principle of medical ethics, that whatever you do, the first principle is don't make things worse and don't use your skill to harm the patient. And of course, up until recently, that included both abortion and euthanasia, which were regarded as intensely harmful and damaging procedures, and therefore doctors should not engage in those procedures.
Mm. Do you think, therefore, that the kind of renewed interest in euthanasia that, I guess, kicked off in the late 20th century, in the 1990s, in places like the Netherlands, and is now rapidly advancing through the Western world? You know, Canada is one of many countries now that offer some forms of assisted suicide euthanasia, and the UK could very well soon be joining that if the House of Lords passes the assisted dying bill, which is coming back for its second reading next week. Do you think that's all downstream of abortion then? Do you think abortion was a kind of necessary first step to begin altering the foundations of what modern medicine is, that has made it possible for doctors down the line, as culture gradually shifts, to begin considering euthanasia and assisted suicide?
No, in the sense that it's at a much deeper level. It's at a deep level of philosophy about the value of life and the significance of human life. That's been shifting, you know, since the Enlightenment. So, you know, people were talking about euthanasia back in the 19th century, long before they were talking about legalizing abortion. Hmm. It was a natural thing to start considering once you lost the idea that every human life was uniquely precious.
Yes.
I think that's at the core of it. Now, why abortion happened much earlier than euthanasia, I think that's probably reflects changes in medical paternalism. You know, that was all to do with the 70s and the 80s, the rise of feminism, you know, my body, my choice. That happened to push directly against the kind of the sanctity of unborn life. And that happened much earlier. Mm. And I think the truth is that there was an innate conservatism in the medical profession. I mean, you know, by and large, the medical profession doesn't represent the most radical, thrusting, testing the limits kind of people. The vast majority of people who got through medical education and are working as doctors tend to be conservative with a small c. And also the Christian influence within medicine has always been very strong. So one way of describing all this, which I think is a helpful image, is the acids of modernity. So what has happened is that since the Enlightenment, the whole infrastructure of thinking about life and death and health and everything else has slowly been eroded by these acids of modernity. But it's taken a couple of hundred years for those acids to really eat through all those structures. But once the acids have done their work, all of a sudden, the whole infrastructure collapses remarkably rapidly.
Yes, I think that's a helpful image. And I think clearly euthanasia and its modern incarnation grows out of, is downstream from, as you say, Enlightenment, because it's about individualism. It's primarily in the Western world, euthanasia has been driven by a kind of elite liberal concern by high status, wealthy, powerful people who hate the idea of being out of control, of the loss of autonomy, and fear that they will have to linger in pain in the last years of their life, and they wish to be given the autonomy and the agency to be able to end their life or have a doctor end their life for them on their behalf. And it's clearly, as you say, it's a product of individualism and the kind of eating away of the idea of human beings existing within community rather than as atomized individuals.
Yeah, and the other thing I would point to, which I think is very significant and hasn't had enough attention, is changing attitudes to suicide.
Yes.
So in the ancient pagan world, pre-Christian world, suicide was often seen as a noble and appropriate way for people to end their lives, particularly elites. Yes. You know, so the death of a hero,
wasn't it? Yeah.
It was an honourable way. You know, you took the honourable route out. And all these different cultures had different ways of doing of suicide, but it was nonetheless, it was celebrated and entirely appropriate. And it was the Christians, well, started with the Jewish nation, who opposed suicide and saw it as an evil, as an act of despair. But then the Christians took that on and opposed suicide all the way right from the early church. And gradually that opposition to suicide passes into the Christianized West. Hmm. And for 2,000 years, we've took it for granted that suicide is a horrific thing, something to be opposed, never to be recommended. Everyone, you know, and suicide prevention is still a massive part of modern thinking. But again, starting, I think, in the 1960s, 70s, particularly starting in the Netherlands, comes the idea that actually suicide is an appropriate. And I still I remember one of the very early images, propaganda poster images for the euthanasia program in the Netherlands, had someone in a kind of three-piece suit, dressed up with great respectability, stepping into a coffin. And underneath the slogan was, "Everyone has the right to die with dignity." And that sort of encapsulates this kind of rehabilitation of suicide under medical control as being an appropriate and noble way to end your life.
Do you think tying into this is the other obviously massive shift around suicide and Western culture has been our growing compassion? And, you know, more than, you know, let's say about 100 years ago, it was illegal. It was a crime. And the church had developed taboos against it, such as, you know, you cannot be buried on consecrated ground. And even within the Anglican church, until the post-war era, you couldn't receive a normal funeral service if you had killed yourself. And And then that has obviously seen an enormous sea change. And now we primarily view people who commit suicide as tragic figures who have acted normally out of a mental health condition or some kind of depression, who we should have enormous compassion and empathy for. And we should not seek to kind of stigmatize or denigrate them after their deaths. But at the same time, we maintained a belief that suicide was never the right answer and was always a tragedy and must be prevented. And I'm now wondering, is that window from about 1960 to 2020, where we said suicide is not evil, it's not sinful, it's not taboo, but it's also not a positive response to what you are suffering, was actually an unstable consensus that was always going to collapse towards, well, suicide, if it's no longer an evil sin, could it also be a positive good for some people?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm not sure I agree with that. It's often said, you know, we're just more compassionate than people were. I just don't buy that. I mean, if you read any of those historical documents, you know, there are voices of intense compassion and sensitivity and sympathy, including many Christian voices and so on. I think what has changed in that period is really the growth of understanding of mental illness and the sort of psychologizing turn. You know, so again, this is one of the features of late modernity, is that we think of everything now in psychological terms. It's the sort of therapeutic
lens through which we view the world.
Yeah, everything is. So in other words, you know, it's no longer people are sad or people are, you know, angry, or, you know, we have a problem with anger feelings, or we have, you know, we have mood instability, and I think positively there was a recognition that most people who committed suicide in reality were not doing it out of defiance to God and shaking their fist in disbelief, but they were doing it because of depression and the recognition that suicidal thoughts are actually a feature of depression, which was a sort of growth and understanding in psychiatry, obviously means we need to rethink our attitude towards people who are committing suicide. So I think it's really that psychological turn. Has that made us more... Possibly. I mean, if you put so much emphasis on the emotional content of your life, then the problem comes, yes, but I just want to die. This is my overriding internal feeling. Maybe there is a kind of feeling, well, in that case, you know, why not? Why not give you the means of out? Having said that, I mean, for instance, in the assisted dying debate here in the UK, that was not seen as at all grounds, which was why they restricted it. The law was restricted to only 6 months of a terminal illness. So the fact that you were depressed and wanted to die, which may have been going on for decades, was absolutely no justification for ending your life. It was only if you had a terminal illness. So there is still a lot of resistance.
And in fact, when people in Parliament even used the S word, suicide, they were often very angrily attacked by the pro-assisted dying side. How dare you call an assisted death a suicide? This is not a suicide. This is completely different. How dare you? How dare you? That's insulting. This is not suicide, which speaks to me as, one, just untrue, but also it shows that why do they want to distance themselves? Because suicide retains a degree of taboo. It is seen as something that is bad. Assisted deaths are good, and therefore assisted death cannot be a suicide.
Yeah, and this is one of the remarkable features of the whole euthanasia debate, which is been going on, as I said, since the 19th century, and that is, it's all about euphemisms. You know, all the pro-euthanasia, right from the 19th century, were finding gentle, euphemistic terms for mercy killing. You know, you never call a spade because it causes... And so, you know, we talk about assisted dying, we talk about...
an easeful death.
The passing, and...
Well, even euthanasia itself is Greek for good death.
Euthanatos, yes it is. It's a euphemistic euphemism. Right from the start. And it's and it's still going on. And, yeah. you know, and what is extraordinary to me is how it's often highly sophisticated senior lawyers whose entire career is based on the precise meaning of exact of words in a law, who are now choosing these deliberately obfuscatory terms, you know, which they know perfectly well are extremely vague and hard to define.
Well, there's no one like lawyers to be able to come up with kind of Jesuitical approaches to language to box and dance around from the main point. But that's a slightly cynical journalistic comment, which we'll move on
it to. It is. Strike it from the record.
Strike from the record. Let's return to where we started, which is with this proposal in Quebec, the kind of hook for this conversation, the proposal in Quebec to extend euthanasia to newborn children. Is this a massive Rubicon, given that previously euthanasia has been framed around that idea of this is about the free consent of adults who or mature children who are choosing, they want to die, and who are we to deny them that autonomy? Well, if we're saying, actually, we also want to euthanize newborn children who by definition don't even know they're alive, really, let alone have the ability to request a death, Is this a philosophical Rubicon? Are we, if this goes through, would it be, in Canadian terms at least, completely redrawing the philosophical justification for assisted dying?
Well, it does go to the root of a kind of deep philosophical contradiction and confusion in the whole area. So when euthanasia is first, in the modern era, when it is first proposed in the Netherlands, the phrase that was used and is still used was hopeless and unbearable suffering. And those two words were chosen with great care. So hopeless means the suffering is of such intensity. Sorry, unbearable means that the suffering is of such intensity that no human being could be expected to continue to bear it. It was utterly unbearable. And then hopeless means there's absolutely no prospect of it getting better. And so the logic of the law is once you have hopeless and unbearable suffering, then the doctor has to do something because this is clearly utterly intolerable. And the doctor's first duty is to prevent suffering. And so that was the way the law initially was framed in the Netherlands, that it was the doctor's response. In fact, they used the legal doctrine of necessity, which is where there is no alternative. I didn't want to do it, honestly. But the patient was suffering unbearably and there was no prospect of it getting better. So then,
just a side note quickly, a similar language was originally in Canada's law. They used the language of irremedial suffering, which is the same idea.
And that has been
gradually nibbled away at because clearly not. There's plenty of people who are getting euthanasia in Canada who are not experiencing suffering conditions that are uncurable or irremedial.
So once... this is where the contradiction comes in, because, of course, if you just take that is the justification of euthanasia, it's not at all clear what autonomy has got to do with it. Because, you know, whoever it is, if their suffering is one, unbearable, simply cannot be borne, and two, has no prospect of getting better, then the argument goes, we have a duty to stop it. However, Netherlands, because it was a strongly based on, you know, Enlightenment ideas of autonomy, and I understand, you know, it's borne out my knowledge of Dutch people, is that they tend to be an incredibly strong-willed and individualistic society. So the law was framed so as said that there had to be an autonomous choice as well. And so... But it's Netherlands who then went on. It starts with children because, you know, what about children? First of all, it's mature minors. What about mature minors? Okay, well, they've sort of got autonomy. So we can, if they really want to die, we can let them die. Okay, but what about children less than 12? You know, parents are saying, my children are in absolute agony. That adolescent is able to ask for death, why can't my child, you know, with cancer or some horrible other congenital condition? And so the in Netherlands and in Belgium, with the parents' consent, euthanasia is being carried out within the ages of 1 to 12? And then what about less than 1? Okay, once we've crossed that Rubicon, we find it hard to justify it. Interestingly, though, and this is a point I've made many times in the debate, once you get to the newborn and you use words, as is used, of hopeless and unbearable suffering, you know, and particularly this is used of children with congenital abnormalities, such as Edwards syndrome or spina bifida or so on. I mean, I'm a neonatologist. I've looked after newborn babies for 25, 30 years. I know that these babies with severe congenital malformations or such as Edwards syndrome or spina bifida, they don't suffer more than any other baby. I mean, they are very similar to other babies. In other words, they don't particularly like having their nappies changed. They don't like having blood tests. But apart from that, you know, they lie there and sleep most of the time and wake up and feed. And occasionally, if they're uncomfortable, it's very easy to control their pain with really quite mild painkillers. So the idea that these babies with who are being offered euthanasia because of spina bifida or other severe malformations are having hopeless and unbearable suffering is just nonsense.
So are we really saying that the impetus for this is actually about salving either the doctor's discomfort from the child's condition or more likely the parent's discomfort, but being framed as though it's done on behalf of the child?
Well, they would strongly deny that. But I think emotionally and psychologically, that is the case. I mean, it is intensely painful for a parent to look at a child that has an impairment, and it tears your heart out thinking, what are the implications going to be for this child in the future? And so is it the parents who are suffering? I think what they would say if pushed is it's all future suffering. What I'm thinking about, certainly in the case of a child who might survive long term with spina bifida, is I'm putting myself in their place when they're 15, when they're 25, and they're in a wheelchair and in having incontinence and requiring multiple aids and so on. And I'm saying they're going to be intensely suffering, and therefore it's my duty to stop that suffering now by ending the life.
Mm. I mean, the other way around to say is that rather than seeing this as euthanasia, where the age gets constantly lowered and lowered and lowered, could this actually be abortion, where we're just pushing the age forward, 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 forward? So, you know, we've discussed many times on this podcast, the UK's law, it says that while there is a 24-week limit on abortions for so-called social reasons, if there is a diagnosable, you know, serious medical disability in the child, abortion is legal all the way up to term. And maybe this is actually in, I mean, I know it's taking place in Canada. I'm not entirely sure what Canadians' abortion laws are, but is this philosophically actually an extension of saying, look, if the child has some very serious medical disability, that would mean that everyone would agree that it's totally permissible to abort them aged 39 weeks and 6 days. Is there any real reason why we wouldn't do a post-birth abortion?
Well, there is a paper with exactly that title, Post-Birth Abortion, arguing that the same criteria should be applied to newborn babies. I mean, again, interestingly, when its publication in the Journal of Medical Ethics led to a howl of outrage around the world, because there is intense sensitivity about newborn babies. And again, I, as a neonatologist, have often noticed this, how the attitude to the unborn, even at term, is very different from the attitude to the babies once they're born, even very preterm babies. So there's a kind of, I'm sorry to say it, but it's largely sentimentality. Look at the little darling. Oh, isn't he gorgeous? You know, whereas, you know, if we can't see them, yeah, well, I think if the mum wants to get rid of them, that's absolutely fine. And I do remember when I was working as a neonatologist, conversations, you know, with parents and colleagues where a diagnosis of a very severe disabling condition had been diagnosed antenatally, and the fetus, you know, would have met the criteria for what was called a late foeticide. where the unborn baby's life would be ended in the womb. And there was this discussion, of course, if we allow this to go to birth, once this baby's been born, quotes, our hands are tied. You know, we're not going to be able to do anything. So, you know, because that's the nature of the UK law, quotes, mm-hmm. you know, and again, it's a kind of euphemistic terminology, but though that's the extraordinary challenge. So I'd like to just reflect just a little bit on the, because I've been in this situation many times, on what I see as a sort of collision between the ethics of intrauterine life and abortion and the ethics of neonatology and newborn life, and why they're so different.
Did you know that this podcast and so many others from Premier Insight is completely reliant on the supporters of listeners like you? It is true, and the impact is profound. One longtime atheist shared, "I find this show and its guests deeply encouraging as I continue on my personal faith journey." Another listener said, "During the worst bombardment of voices, this podcast lifted me up and gave me hope." This is what your support makes possible, and why on this fifth anniversary of Premier Insight, your support is so urgently needed. If you believe that this kind of ministry is needed and that more people need to be reached with this content, then I'm asking you to respond with a gift today. Just visit premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death today. Your gift is needed to help equip believers, reach skeptics, and keep biblical truth in the conversation. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Because as I think we might have mentioned this previously, but there is a very interesting distinction that the early church, a different approach the early church takes to when it thinks about and considers the value of newborn children, which we find quite difficult to step outside of 2000 years of Christendom, which has so suffused our culture in every direction that it feels completely natural. But actually, the way that the early Christians in the first centuries after Christ thought and acted around newborn children was considered baffling, even scandalous, by the Greco-Roman world they were a small minority in.
Yeah, and I can still remember when I discovered all this, because I think it's much better known now because of people like Tom Holland and others who've been writing about this. But way back in the ancient history, which was sort of the 1980s, when I was first getting interested in this whole area, I started reading some dusty tomes about ancient medical history. And I can still remember a light bulb moment, because I was wrestling with the question of, you know, what is a Christian response to all this? How do Christians in about abortion, about the challenges of extremely preterm babies? And I can remember reading the some of these accounts of the early Christian church. And it was kind of light bulb goes on in my head. Of course, this is the Christian response. This is what it looks like. It isn't primarily about campaigning. The Christians didn't go out onto the barricades. And I mean, they did get involved in the public debate when they had an opportunity, but by and large, they didn't. They weren't involved in a great deal of discussions in the Senate and elsewhere. What they were doing is they were just practically reaching out to their neighbors, and they were doing what the pagans found utterly extraordinary, which was they were rescuing abandoned babies. Because infanticide and child exposure was completely common, very common, in many places in the ancient world. And there are even descriptions of people going walking up hills and coming across the bodies of babies, you know, just abandoned. It was well known, particularly where the prostitutes were, that they were the abandoned babies and so on the rubbish heaps and elsewhere. And this was just part of everyday life. But these extraordinary Christians have got these weird ideas, because instead of seeing this as just the sad necessity of unwanted lives, they go out of their way and actually rescue these little scraps, and they bring them in, and they look after them and care for them and adopt them into their own families. And apparently what then happens is that when the pagan, the mothers of their neighbors discover these Christians have these weird ideas, instead of abandoning their babies on the mountaintops or elsewhere, and they abandon their babies outside the doors of the Christians. And then there are descriptions of the early Christian churches just completely overwhelmed with abandoned orphans that are being looked after. And they had a place called the Brefatoria, which means the children's center within the churches where all these kids were being looked after. So, and the philosophers at the time comment about this and how extraordinary it was.
In fact, it's one of the most common things, isn't it? When you read early kind of first, second, third century accounts where kind of pagan Greco-Roman people mention this strange Jewish sect that's starting to spread across the empire, one of the alongside a kind of reluctance to take up arms in being soldiers and a few other things, one of the things they almost always mention is that they have this very curious custom of collecting and caring for other people's abandoned, exposed children. It's so startling to them. It's worthy of mention as one of the most unusual things about these weird Christians.
I think that's right. And I think you can trace it to two things. One is this deep, deep understanding of the image of God, which applies throughout the life course, starting for the unborn and all the way through to death. Every human being is unique and special, made in God's image. But secondly, I've absolutely no doubt that it was all about the incarnation, because the idea that God himself turns himself into one of these little beings. I mean, we are so familiar with this idea that it just seems completely normal and natural. But actually, the ancient world found this both scandalous and also disgusting. I mean, you know, the idea that God Almighty, of all purity and power, and, you know, the source of all goodness, and that is turns himself into a pathetic little baby who squits down his mother's back and needs to be, I mean, it's just disgusting. And yet the Christians believed this. And because Jesus was a baby, all babies are special. And that has now, of course, come in, is now commonplace. We're a very baby-orientated society. We think babies are wonderful.
Yeah. And as you say, it's so kind of become the water we swim in that it, even to the present day, among people who would have absolutely nothing to do with Christianity, still are, you know, it's still shocking when someone follows the consistent philosophical trend through from, well, look, if we're prepared to abort a child at 40 weeks who's inside the mother's womb, the location of this child relative to the uterine canal should not determine its worth, and we should be prepared to commit infanticide. And yet that is, apart from a few bravey post-Christendom souls like Peter Singer, is deemed kind of taboo in culture, because we have adopted this very, very insistent idea that the second a child is born, they are of total equal status to you, me. The most mighty in our society is no greater value than this tiny baby, only a few minutes old.
And I often reflected on that. You know, when I was working in the intensive care unit, which was in WC1, London, centre of London, and I sometimes reflected that, you know, here I was caring for this incredibly vulnerable little preterm baby, sometimes literally 500 grams, tubes coming out of every orifice, and we were struggling to save this life, which was teetering by a thread. And I reflected to myself that according to English law, if I was to deliberately take a syringe and take the life, kill this little preterm baby, I'm guilty of exactly the same offence as if I marched down to 10 Downing Street and wipe out the head of the state. And if you try to explain that to any ancient Roman jurist, they would think
they would laugh at you.
Completely nonsensical. And yet we accept that. And that's just evidence of how still profoundly the Judeo-Christian understanding of life is still penetrated in our legal system.
And so is your case, therefore, that the gulf in how we treat children from the minute they're born compared to the minute before they're born is an example of how our what Christendom didn't penetrate backwards in time into the first 9 months of life before birth, or is that a way that actually we're rediscovering a more pagan approach to human life, which is why we're more comfortable as a society with abortion than we are with pediatric euthanasia?
Well, I recognise this is a bit simplistic and overly generalised, but the way I view it is that once abortion started in the UK, and particularly selective abortion, so once we decided that we could do genetic tests or ultrasound scans and decide whether or not to abort this particular baby based on its likely long-term disability, we've actually, that is the Greco-Roman understanding of newborn life. That is the disposable, you know, you only bring in. So I came across, to my utter astonishment, reading an ancient textbook by Greek physician, Roman physician, Serenus, and it's the oldest textbook of gynecology. It's got a chapter called And for midwives, he's written a textbook for midwives, and he's got a chapter called How to Recognize the Newborn That Is Worth Rearing. And he's got a very modern sounding neonatal examination, which I recognize. Now, this is how we teach junior doctors to examine newborn babies. You know, you start at the top, you go around, you checked all the ducts and the orifices and so on. And then he says, and by this way, you can recognize the newborn that is worth rearing. And the idea was, you know, if the baby didn't meet the test, it was exposed and you move on to the next one. And this, again, was entirely normal and acceptable. And effectively, that's what we're now doing before birth.
Mm.
We are scanning the baby, assessing them, and deciding whether or not this baby is worth rearing.
Yeah. So in highly reductive terms, what the Christians said is that once we identify someone as a human being in the image of God, they are of equal status to everyone else. Whereas the pagan world said human beings are only worth as much as they are useful or desirable in the eyes of other human beings. And it is perfectly plausible to say this child is not of value. We don't deny its humanity. We just deny its usefulness to the human community. Whereas the Christians said everyone who is a person is valuable.
Right. And so where we are now, just at the moment in this point in history, is that we've got Greco-Roman law in the uterus.
And Judeo-Christian law.
Judeo-Christian law at the moment of birth in the neonatal unit. And what you get at the moment of delivery is this extraordinary clash between two ancient thought forms, both of them internally consistent, but completely mutually incompatible.
And is euthanasia, because I've often heard euthanasia described as a kind of Christian heresy in the sense that it's kind of taken the idea of the innate value of every human being too far. The Enlightenment is saying, yeah, human beings are great. We're so great that we should be little gods of our own and have absolute autonomy and sovereignty like we're countries. And we don't belong to a thick community of other human beings. And that's why I should have the right to determine my own death. Or do you see what Quebec is proposing, you know, pediatric newborn euthanasia as an overflow of this kind of pre-Christian lack of value of human life?
Yeah, I would say it's that. I don't think it's not a Christian heresy. There are other things which are Christian heresies, taking fundamentally Christian ideas and just pushing them. But this is, euthanasia has never been a Christian heresy. This is, I think, pre-Christian in it's a throwback to an older understanding, and that's why suicide again is being rehabilitated and viewed as a noble way to be. And interestingly, in Quebec they're also discussing euthanasia for elderly people who are, quote, tired of life. And that is absolutely, that is the pagan understanding of suicide, you know, that I've had my time, it's time to go, and I do the decent thing and end my life. And that has never been seen in Christians as a response to old age. I mean, quite the reverse. Old age was something that was celebrated and seen as a sign of God's blessing and faithfulness. But yeah, and I think these are the acids of modernity. The acids of modernity are destroying the Judeo-Christian structures. And what you're left with is often that pre-Christian view of the world.
2,000 years of Christendom was all a veneer, and it only went so deep it never really got to grips with the human heart.
Well, yes and no, because interestingly, these things are much deeper than I'm struck by how much resistance there is to euthanasia still.
Yeah.
Many, many people are deeply concerned about this. And I suspect that as it advances, more and more people will say, hang on a minute, this can't be right. So what is the alternative? And it may actually contribute to, you know, this renewed awakening in these deep Christian values, which we've just taken for granted.
Or the more pessimistic suggestion is that what we saw is this kind of wacky, extreme, liberal, European stuff they're doing in the Netherlands, you know, where they've had the idea of euthanasia for old elderly people who aren't ill or sick or dying, who just have, quote, a completed life and want to move on. That's been in place for years. They also have pediatric euthanasia for children with the consent of the parents. That was often seen, I think, you know, I remember growing up, you'd read about that in kind of your textbooks in RE lessons at school and go, gosh, that's an extreme thing. It's now increasingly common in kind of common law jurisdictions in the Anglo-American world, in lots of US states, Canada, and very likely soon to be here in England as well. I think it's just as likely that rather than this being the impetus for people to rediscover their Christian ideals about what it means to be human, is that Christians become a diminishing island in a increasingly, to use the phrase, a kind of pagan society. You know, I'm very struck by a quote by Stanley Hauerwas, a theologian, who said, you know, in 100 years, if Christians are people identified as those who do not kill their children and do not kill the elderly, we will have been doing something right. And I think that's quite plausible. I think in 100 years' time, I think it will be very possible that everyone in society basically accepts that some children should be euthanized and some old people should be euthanized. And it is the Christians who are weird for saying no.
Well, this is getting very close to home, Tim, so I just hope you remember that in my dotage, that you don't revert to pagan thinking. Just checking, you know. Yeah. Okay.
No promises. I think there is a... And maybe that is... I mean, obviously it's not desirable, it's tragic. But maybe there is at least a crystallizing, a clarifying that we do live in a post-Christendom age and we are more like that early church when it was 1% of the population and it was living out its faith in ways that were scandalous and radical and baffling to the Greco-Roman society around it. And the church got kind of lazy living in Christendom and enjoying some of the benefits of not having to kind of make the case and live in that countercultural way. And maybe the circle is turning and we're coming back round to a world where the church is going to be a small remnant living in a radical countercultural way, at great pressure and from its pagan society to stop this and do what we do and just start exposing your kids again.
Yeah, we probably want to bring this conversation to a close, but I just want to say, I think that's just too simplistic because the truth is we can't go back to that pre-Christian era.
Mm.
The era we're moving into is a post-Christendom era. It's a post-Christendom era. In other words, this is now, we've got 2,000 years of history of influence, of Christian influence in absolutely everything that we do. And yes, those things will change and maybe sadly decay, but they won't go back to the pre-Christian era. We're going to be left with some kind of strange remnants of
fossilized.
Of fossilized, era. Yeah, exactly. And Christian heresies and so on. And therefore, there's a limit to how much we can learn from the early church. Yes, of course, we can learn how they responded. I think there is the prospect of a much more vocal euthanasia resistance movement and the creation of independent Christian healthcare facilities. That's what I think is going to start happening. And in response to the increasing sort of medical killing within the secularist institutions. But what I predict is if those Christian healthcare institutions start coming into existence across the West, they will be immensely popular, just as the pagan Christians were, because the population are not stupid and they will recognize the quality of care that they could well receive in Christian institutions. So it's a complex, rapidly evolving new era. We've never been here before. No. We've never been in a post-Christendom era before. No. I think there are going to be new threats, but new opportunities.
Yeah, I think I probably do agree with you. I think history doesn't go in cycles. It goes in one direction. And while we can absolutely learn things from the past, and it is instructive to think back to those early days when Christians were a tiny minority in an alien culture, you are right fundamentally that we can't just, it's not a circle. It's a forward moving arrow. And therefore the church is going to have to do a lot of work to figure out what it means to live counterculturally in a post-Christendom era, which, as you say, is completely virgin territory. No church, we here in the West are at the cutting edge, unfortunately. No Christians have ever lived in a godless society that still is being built on the kind of godly foundations of Christendom and has echoes of truth in a world that is rejecting God. And so, yeah, it's a brave new world. And the coming centuries will be, as you say, a time of a lot of challenges and a lot of opportunities. Shall we call it quits there?
Yeah, just a final comment. And that is the gifting that is most required in this kind of era is then innovation. It's the innovation, the ability to think outside the box and say, what would an innovatory, fresh Christian approach be in a post-Christian, post-Christendom society? That's what we desperately need.
Yeah. Well, there's the call. Let's hope people pick up the baton. Let's call it quits there. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this story and what we've been talking about. You can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. We also really welcome in questions from the listeners, disagreements, comments, but also if you've spotted an interesting development in science, technology, healthcare, ethics, culture that you think you'd like us to talk about in a future episode, please do get in touch. As I mentioned, we've covered some of these topics around euthanasia, Canada, abortion. It's a regular for us here on MOLAD. So I'll put some links to previous episodes and also in the show notes. And also there's lots on Dad's website. If you'd like to read more about these topics, you can find that at johnwyatt.com. That's W-Y-A-T-T. As always, if you'd like to read some of my journalism, you can find my writing linked to on my website, which is tswyatt.com. And in particular, I would recommend you subscribe for free to my weekly church news newsletter, The Critical Friend. Links for that also on the same website. That's all. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.